Minutes later, Alima was in a cargo hold, hurtling between tall, lashed-together stacks of plasteel containers, continuing to move as fast as she could, certain that pursuing Jedi were just an instant behind her. They had to be using the ship's holocam system. Alima didn't understand. She thought that her techniques would defeat it. The enemy must have new techniques. A door in the bulkhead ahead of her hissed open, and a man stepped through. He wore a full-coverage garment of glistening blue material and a helmet, narrower and closer than a pilot's. Its faceplate was transparent, and through it she recognized the features of Jagged Fell. He extended an empty hand. "Alima, surrender. I guarantee..." She raised her blowgun and shot him. He pitched forward. No, he knelt forward. He was drawing his holstered blaster before she'd realized he wasn't dead, wasn't dying. Armor. He had to be wearing armor. He raised his blaster and shot her. The blast struck her in the left shoulder, spinning her around, throwing her to the ground. Pain lanced through her. Pain and a realization that he'd broken her clavicle, that he'd further mutilated her. She rolled to one side as he shot again. The blast missed her. She lashed out at him through the force, sweeping him aside, hurling him deep into a mass of cargo crates. The wall of crates, held together by tough webbing, folded in on itself as if devouring Jag. She got up and ran, staggering worse than ever through the doorway by which Jag had entered. Leia was the first of the pursuers to reach the hangar bay used by the Errant Venture customers who had rented compartments for more than a day. The main doors in the floor were open, and a shabby YV-666 light freighter was sinking through them into space. Alima Rar was in the cockpit. Leia exchanged looks, promising mayhem or death with her for a second, and then the transport was out of sight.
"She stole my ship!"
Levin clamped her head between her hands as if trying to prevent an explosion. She spun around as if seeking some corner of her small stateroom where she could find refuge from the truth.
"My ship!"
Han glanced at Leia and shrugged.
"Actually, she's taking it better than I expected."
Leia awkwardly patted the captain's shoulder.
"I know you must have loved your ship."
Levent was abruptly still.
"Actually, I hated her, but she was still worth something."
She shrugged.
"Oh, well... I have another one coming."
"Speaking of what you have coming..."
Han produced a data card and held it before her. She reached for it, but he kept it out of her grasp, and now she eyed him suspiciously.
"What is it?"
"The location of the Confederation meeting you told me about," Han said. "Place and time."
Levin's eyes gleamed.
"So give it over. I met the terms of our contract."
Leia shook her head, smiling with just a little bit of malice.
"That was no contract. You made requests, remember?"
"True."
Levin didn't look too disappointed.
"But you obtained and brought the information, so it must be on the table."
"It is," Han said. "But among other things, we want to know what it's for. It cost me a lot of favors to get."
"Oh."
Levin considered and looked between them.
"I'm going to give it to a man, for a ship, and to clear me out of his life, out of his consideration."
"Is he likely to turn it over to the Galactic Alliance government?"
Leia asked. Levin nodded instantly.
"I'd put the likelihood at about 100%.
Leia said.
"I don't think we can..."
But Han handed Levin the card. Leia finished smoothly.
"Protest too much after all the help you gave us."
She shot Han a bewildered look.
"Are we done here?"
"I think so."
Han gave Levent a professional, pleasant smile and led Leia to the door.
"Try to stay out of trouble."
Soon,
Levent said.
"Nice meeting you at last."
Out in the corridor, Leia said,
"All right, I'm completely confused. As much as you've supported the Corellian cause..."
"Why have I suddenly turned traitor?"
Han finished.
"Sweetheart, I didn't have as much trouble as I should have had getting that information. Which means one of two things. Either security's not what it should be for that meeting, meaning the Galactic Alliance will have it soon anyway, meaning all I've done is to give her a couple of days' head start in getting the information to them. Or there's a lot of disinformation out there, meaning that everybody who gets deep enough is getting a different wrong answer. If it's the first one, then Levent gets her reward from her government contact. No loss to me or Corellia. If it's the second one, Levent and her government contact will wander into a trap. Probably a Durgegen trap set up for us.
Zyost.
This set of ruins was no heap of rubble, which was good, since Ben wasn't sure he could reach the next place on the map. He had been 3 days without food, Kyera won. Shaker was down to draining energy from the various batteries Ben had brought from Faskus's camp. Of them, he retained only a partial charge in the primary blaster pistol. The data pads didn't count. Their batteries didn't contain enough energy to permit an R2 unit to walk 4 steps. But this set of ruins, it clustered high on a mountain ridge, built just below a cliffside hundreds of meters tall. The cliff looked like a portion of the mountain had been sliced away by a giant lightsaber millions of years in the past, leaving the stone to weather until some species decided to build a citadel here. Not some species, the original Sith species. The citadel was made of black and mottled gray stone and looked large enough to house 1,000 people. But no one lived there now, Ben thought, not that he could be sure. He detected little flickers of life through the Force, but those impressions were always washed away by the flow of dark side energy that emanated from the place. Like the planet itself, the Citadel was suffused in such energy, but more so. Still, the voices were pleased that he was here. He heard them even when he was awake now, and when he dreamed, they taught him how to fly the eye-shaped craft they had shown him.
Coruscant, Senate Building, Admiral Nyathal's office.
Nyathal answered the beep with a gravelly command.
Come in!
Jason Solo entered, dressed in his immaculate black guard uniform and a flowing black cloak. He gave her a crisp salute. Admiral? Nyathal returned it.
Sit! Hurry! I have a meeting in 30 minutes.
Jason sat. Galadar.
I don't understand.
Probably because I hurried. Galadar 8 is where the Confederation meeting is going to take place. The election of your counterpart, their supreme military commander, and the launch point of their next fleet action. Nyathal sat up straighter.
Intelligence has been working on this all this time, and you come up with an answer first?
I have sources distinct from intelligences.
Such as your parents?
Nyathal didn't miss the slight frown that crossed Jason's features. My parents had nothing to do with obtaining this information. It's from another smuggling resource I've been cultivating for months.
Interesting. When?
2 weeks. Actually, 13 standard days. Nearly exactly. Nyathal made an exasperated noise.
It will take that long at least to put together a coordinated response. We're going to rush into our counterplan and get good people killed as a consequence.
If I may. Jason drew a data card from a pocket and set it on the desk before Nyathal. I've taken the liberty of putting together a proposal. For a response you would probably consider uncoordinated, but it would get forces there fast and possibly undetected. And I doubt our equally uncoordinated enemy will anticipate it. Nyathal gave him a dubious look and inserted the card into her desk slot. Jason's plan was simple and unconventional. Galadar was an undistinguished mid-rim star, not far from Ancien. Not one of its worlds was habitable for most of the galaxy's sapient species. The planet Galadar 8 was a gas giant, a world whose surface was a beautiful glowing swirl of mottled reds, oranges, and yellows. At one point in the distant past, it had been a favorite vacation spot for the Old Republic, circled by a ring of resort satellites from which patrons could marvel at its natural beauty. But taste changed, and the brief era in which planetary artistic appreciation could serve as the be-all and end-all of a wealthy family's vacation ended. And with it, the years of usefulness of the Galadar system. The last resort satellite had gone out of business a century and a half ago, and Jason's estimation was that the resort would probably be the site of the meeting to come. Step one of his plan was to send Jedi-piloted Stealth X snub fighters into the system, giving the Alliance military information about the Confederation forces already there, particularly sensor platforms. Step two involved bringing in forces selected from fleets and task forces already in that area of the galaxy, choosing them carefully to keep any one unit from losing too much strength and defeating the ability of spies and analysts to determine where those reassigned craft were going. Step three had Jedi observers directing Alliance forces into the system, avoiding sensor observation or scouting patrols, and setting them up within the atmosphere of Galator 8. The glowing, radiant atmosphere was so thin at its upper reaches, barely denser than the empty space in a standard solar system, that vehicles and vessels of all varieties could be stationed there. Such a world tended to emit higher levels of electromagnetic radiation, making communication between vehicles more difficult, but also making detection more difficult. Step three would continue until the mission commander concluded that it was no longer possible to sneak forces into the atmosphere of Galator 8. And even then, larger capital ships could muster at a point outside the system and be ready to jump in. In step four, the Stealth X observers would signal when the meeting had begun, and all the Alliance forces would move in against the Confederation forces. Nyathol and her analysts evaluated Jason's plan, and over the span of a day, considered and discarded several others. Eventually, they settled on Jason's. It would have to be modified and detailed, but it would serve as a template. At their next meeting, Nyathol informed Jason of her decision and said,
"I will lead this mission myself."
He nodded, apparently pleased. "I also want to be there."
"With the Anakin Solo?"
"Yes."
"Good. Consider it authorized."
As he emerged from the Senate building, Jason felt a familiar presence. He did not react visibly as the tall woman wrapped in anonymous garments, her lower face shrouded by a scarf, fell into step beside him. "How are you?" he asked.
"Well," Lumaya answered, "fully healed."
"Interested in going on an expedition?"
"I sense that you are moving into a troubled period, into much danger. That's why I came."
"I'll take that as a yes." Jason changed the subject. "Any news of Ben?"
"No. His monitors have temporarily lost track of him."
A note of worry entered her voice.
"He may not have survived."
"I think I would have felt it if he had died."
"Perhaps not, where he is."
Jason didn't ask. "I have faith in him."
"Clearly so," she said.
Zyost.
The last kilometer of the climb up to the Citadel was comparatively easy. The roadway made of dressed black stone slabs that were cracked here and there, but otherwise seemed little worn by the passage of time, wheels, or feet, allowed Shaker comparatively quick passage. But the little droid began to slow again, 200 meters from the tumble of rock that apparently marked the Citadel's main entrance, and came to a complete stop 100 meters from it. Ben felt like stopping too. He shook from cold and hunger. He returned slowly to Shaker's side, noting that the droid's lights were still functioning. He pulled out his datapad.
"What's wrong, little guy?"
"I lack sufficient power to move farther."
Ben thought about sighing, but didn't want to expend the energy.
"How long can you stay awake on the charge you have if you don't move?"
"Perhaps 12 hours.
"All right. Shut down now. I'll wake you up when I've found a power source."
It took Ben and Kiara the better part of 4 hours to climb to the top of the rubble heap that blocked the main entrance into the Citadel. From the top, Ben could see the trench-like gap between portions of outer wall that had not fallen and the high, more intact inner wall of the Citadel itself. He could see gray-blue skies and white-capped forest stretching to the horizon. It was all so beautiful that he wanted to stay forever. And it occurred to him that if he killed and ate the little girl, he'd recover his strength swiftly. Maybe he'd even cook her first. But she was looking at him when that thought came, and the way she slowly drew away from him reminded him that the thought was not his own. He forced it away and gave her a little smile, a genuine Ben smile. The stone doors beyond the rock pile were down, and it took far less time to descend into the outermost great chamber of the Citadel.
The only lights available to him were little streaks of sunlight entering by windows near the ceiling. They let him see that there were no furnishings left in this chamber, not even moldy, tattered remnants. It had been stripped of goods long ago. All that remained were entryways into black hallways and curved stone staircases going up or down. He desperately wanted to descend. He knew the eyeball-shaped ship was somewhere below, hidden, waiting for him, calling to him. But he had no strength, and he knew that if he were to become the ship's master, he would have to conquer it.
"We'll camp here,"
he told Kiara. She looked around dubiously, but said nothing. Ben slept and dreamed that in the darkest hour of the night, something detached itself from the ceiling far above. It looked like three giant balls, the center one slightly larger and attached to the other two by pivots. A cluster of five legs emerged from each end ball, and they worked together to allow the thing to walk slowly down the wall. In his dream, he said,
"Go away."
"No, this is my home now. Your kind is gone. I shall eat you."
"I'll kill you."
It paused halfway down the wall.
"Give me the little piece of meat. I will leave you alone."
"I'll kill you."
It began its descent again.
"Outside,"
Ben said.
"Their necks hunting me. I couldn't bring myself to eat the first one. Now I wish I had. But you can. Go outside and hunt the necks. They'll be close."
The thing stopped again and waited a full minute. Then it changed course, moving toward the top of the rock pile. Rocks tumbled down the pile as it squeezed through the opening. In his dream, Ben thought he heard necks howling.
"Eat, girl. Grow strong."
The voices faded as Ben awoke. Hurriedly, he glanced around. Kiara, looking pale, her features sharpening from strain and starvation, was still asleep next to him. The ceiling was better illuminated. Around its edges there were many odd shapes. Curved balconies, broken statuary, other forms he couldn't identify. He wondered if any of them might become the thing he had seen in his dream. He prodded Kiara awake.
"Come on, we have work to do."
"Are we going to wake Shaker up?"
"I hope so."
As his last act of preparation, Ben reconnected the tracer's severed antenna leg to its main body, then hung the pouch loop around the dummy he'd constructed. It wasn't much of a dummy, just a carefully built pile of stone with red blankets draped around it. But perhaps it would do. It was situated at a spot where the outer wall still stood and the base of the inner wall was littered with stones that had fallen from the high reaches. The pouch hung from its neck. Kiara following, Ben retreated past the shriveled, frozen neck body they had discovered upon emerging that morning. They found a spot concealed between two courses of dressed stone, and they waited. Time passed. In the stillness, Ben began to hear the voices again.
"Eat, girl. Grow strong."
"You used to want me to protect her."
Ben had thought his words inaudible, but Kiara spoke up.
"Who are you talking to?"
"No one."
"Eat, girl."
Why were the voices different now? That was a puzzle. And Jason had always said that puzzles should always be solved because then they became information that could be used. He tried to look at the voice's suggestion rationally. It made sense on a purely logical level. If he killed, cooked, and ate Kiara, he would have several days' worth of food.
"Eat, girl. Grow strong."
If he did kill and eat her, he'd never be caught, never be punished. In fact, just about every logical argument Ben could come up with suggested that eating Kiara was the most appropriate action. The plan Ben had just set in motion might not work. It might take days to complete. He could be dead before then. Every logical argument, Ben frowned. But not all arguments had to be logical. Kiara was a little girl,
one who had just lost her father, her daddy. Never mind that her daddy seemed to have been a small-time criminal, and the odds supported by files of data Ben had seen on the guard computers were that Kiara would grow up to be a small-time criminal or another type of drain on society. She might grow up to invent a medicine better than Bacta, or to write songs, or to act in holodramas that made things better for people. Or she might have children who did these things, or teach children to do these things. But not if she died now. He wasn't even sure he liked her. They hadn't had energy enough to talk very often on their long walk, but he felt bad for her. He felt protective of her. He felt. And it seemed to him that neither thinking nor feeling needed to be the boss of the other. In a Jedi, they should be mixed. Partners. He wondered if that was the case with the guards as well. None of that answered the question of why the voices had started by suggesting that he protect Kiara and now insisted that he eat her. But the answer, a possible answer anyway, came to him. They had told him to protect her because that's what he had decided to do, and he hadn't known how. In suggesting that they could get Ben and Kiara off this planet alive, they had made Ben listen to them. He had begun to understand them, and then had begun to think the way they thought. And now, they could suggest different things. They could suggest what they'd wanted all along. He felt a burst of anger, but clamped down on it. He didn't have the energy to be angry right now. He noticed that the voices had grown quiet. And in that quietness, Ben told Kiara the story of a young, force-sensitive slave boy who won a pod race on Tatooine and earned his freedom.
"Did they feed him when he won?"
Kiara asked.
"All he could eat, and even more,"
Ben assured her. Not long afterward, Ben sensed the eye in the sky. He looked up into the clouds and pulled his all-weather cloak even tighter around them.
"Is he there?"
"Yes, he is."
This pilot was not subtle. He sent the TIE fighter into a screaming dive that ended up with the vehicle a mere 20 meters above the ground. Then he had to slow and circle, because Ben's dummy was not visible from the open spaces around the Citadel. He had to climb and then drop into the gap between outer and inner wall. And then he lined his lasers up on Ben's dummy. Now, through the Force, Ben exerted himself against the stones at the top of the inner wall, all along the course of the wall above the starfighter. It was hard going. He felt so tired, and it was almost impossible to focus. But an understanding that this might be the difference between life and death, from cold or starvation or mummification, drove him. And he saw the stones high above begin to rock and then fall free. The TIE fighter fired, and Ben's dummy fell over, the blankets catching on fire. The TIE fighter glided forward slowly on repulsors and was a mere 5 meters from the burning dummy when the first stone, no larger than a human head, hit its hull. To his credit, the pilot reacted instantly, veering away and climbing straight into the thickest portion of falling stone. The rocks had fallen more than 100 meters. Some weighed a quarter ton or more. All had sharp right-angled edges, and some of them hit edge first. The TIE fighter spun wildly out of control, hit the Citadel's inner wall, and bounced off again. The twin ion engines were still firing, but the starfighter was spinning so fast that they merely added to the energy of its spiral. It landed beyond the outer wall, its hull collapsing on impact, and continued to roll, shearing off its solar array wings as it did. It rolled half a kilometer before coming to a stop against a natural rock abutment. Ben told Kiara to climb a tree while he examined the wreckage. When he saw what was left of the pilot, a pale-skinned Chev in a bronze uniform, he was glad he had. It didn't take him long to pry open the hatch into the starfighter's small cargo bay. Its contents had broken free of the cloth webbing that had restrained them, but were otherwise intact. 2 days worth of rations for a grown man, a medical kit, power packs, a long-range comlink, a self-inflating raft, water purification tablets. He took it all and scavenged other goods from the Chev's body. Then, as fast as they could manage, he and Kiara ran from the site of the crash and back toward the dubious safety of the Citadel.
It didn't occur to Ben to be sorry about the being whose life he had just taken.
Gilata System, resort station orbiting Gilata 8.
From the distance of several hundred kilometers, Luke watched the activity at the station. He employed passive sensors only, including a holocam utilizing high-grade visual amplification hardware, and knew that Mara, floating less than 100 meters away in her own Stealth X, was doing the same. Half a dozen vehicles were docked at the station. The crews inside were presumably effecting repairs and making the antiquated station ready for the ceremony that would soon take place. Luke, Mara, and their fellow pilots, including Corin, Kip, Jaina, and Zek, plus Jag, finally getting some shift time in Jaina's Stealth X, had scouted out the system pretty thoroughly. There were indeed droid sensor satellites along the standard approaches into the system, but none situated elsewhere, and there were routes to which the sensor array was blind from outside the system to the far side of Gilata 8. The Jedi had already led several ships from the 9th Fleet to orbits within the outer atmosphere of Gilata 8. Another vessel they had guided into place was Admiral Nyathal's temporary flagship, the aged but still mighty Mon Calamari cruiser, Galactic Voyager.
Zyost.
Ben and Kiara rested the remainder of the day, and from the top of the rock pile, just inside the Citadel entrance, they watched the shuttle. It descended from the clouds less than 15 minutes after Ben, Kiara, and the revitalized Shaker reached the entrance. It was an old shuttle with fold-up wings and a bronze paint job, and it did not land. It circled the crash site endlessly, then took off for the skies once more. They slept well that night, with Shaker keeping its sensors alert for nocturnal movement. But there was none. In the morning, glow rods attached to new power packs, they went searching. It didn't take long. All Ben had to do was open himself up to the voices. They led him down several levels to where the corridor floors were coated in ancient muck, to a long side shaft that carried them well away from the Citadel proper. It led them to an unlit circular chamber. Its walls were decorated with 18 niches, each large enough to hold a life-size statue of an average human, but all empty.
"It's gone,"
Kiara said. Ben shook his head. The images in his head were clear. The ship was here.
"Come out,"
he said. He heard laughter. Ben frowned. His instincts and what the voices had whispered to him when he only half understood their words told him that emotion was the key. Nor would kind, soft, welcoming emotion do. He deepened his voice, put some anger into it.
"Come out!"
Had he tried it the day before, when he'd been his weakest from lack of food, he doubtless would have failed. But now there was a rumble in the ground, and a crack appeared in the half-dried muck of the floor. A crack as straight as a laser beam, bisecting the room. The gap widened more quickly at the room's center than toward the edges. There it became circular, and up from it, inadequately illuminated by Ben's glow rod, came a segmented metal arm several meters long, and then the top portions of a vehicle's spherical main body. Its circular central viewport, lit from behind and glowing an unhealthy yellow, seemed to be an eye regarding them. The sphere was some 10 meters in diameter, half of it protruding above floor level. A gap of 3 meters separated the edge of the floor from the nearest portion of vehicle hull. Ben swayed, both from weakness and relief. The vehicle was here. It was real. And if the presence he felt within it, a malevolent set of emotions detectable through the Force, was any indication, it was functional, even after centuries in the ground.
"Open,"
he commanded. After a moment, a vertical line appeared beneath the viewport and lowered as a hatch, its near end just reaching the edge of the floor. Ben bounded across and up into the vehicle. But if he'd anticipated finding a control couch, a pilot's yoke, hyperspace and weapons controls, he was disappointed. The interior, which could have occupied only a fraction of the vehicle's volume, was a single disc-shaped chamber, 4 meters across and 2.5 high. The corridor channel leading to the ramp was the only exit. The walls looked like orange pumice, glowing as though they were thin sheets over molten lava, and the vehicle's interior was very warm. When he got to the center of the disc-shaped chamber, Ben turned around and around, looking for controls, but he found nothing. Ben closed his eyes and tried to get a sense of this place, this vehicle, and he did. For a moment, he saw a red-skinned woman in robes of volcanic hues kneeling, her golden pole arm on the floor beside her. That was it then. The pilot had to communicate with the vehicle through the Force. Quickly, he knelt where the woman in his vision had been.
"Command."
The voice, male, rich in expectant malice, spoke directly into his mind. Ben looked down the ramp and beckoned for Kiara and Shaker.
"Time to go."
The little girl shook her head. The astromech tweedled at her.
"Kiara, we have to leave."
"I don't want to go in that thing,"
she wailed.
"It's gonna eat me."
Ben shot her a reassuring grin.
"And if it does?"
She took a moment to answer.
"He'll jump down its throat, and we'll cut our way out together."
"That's right."
Still reluctant, she came forward, tentatively took her first step onto the ramp, and ran up into the room. She flopped down to sit beside him. A moment later, Shaker rolled into place on his other side and locked its wheels.
"Close,"
Ben commanded, and the ramp lifted. Now was the part he wasn't sure of.
"Launch,"
he said. For long moments, nothing happened, and Ben wondered how many words he would have to go through before he found the correct command. But apparently intent was enough. Intent and visualizing what he wanted to happen. The light outside the vehicle brightened. Suddenly, blinding white, it reached all the way to the niches in the wall. Ben looked up, seeing only the ceiling above him. Then he closed his eyes again and attempted to see as the vehicle saw. And he did. The ceiling above the vehicle had drawn aside in two pieces, and sunlight shone down into the chamber. The vehicle began to tremble like a wild animal preparing to spring.
"Get ready,"
Ben said.
"I think it's going to..."
The vessel accelerated straight upward, its movement pressing Ben and Kiara down onto the floor. Jason and Lumaya separated once inside, the better to acquire information across a broader area. The main chamber of the resort, the dome above recently cleaned to provide an unobstructed view of Galata 8, was laid out with long tables full of food and drink. Delegates wandered from one to the next, or from one small standing group to the next. There was no urgency or animosity to be seen among them. That was curious. As critical as the election of a Supreme War Commander should be, Jason had anticipated more anxiety and more notoriety among the attendees. So far, he hadn't recognized a single face. Jason accepted a drink from a server, a tall, fair-haired woman in a white gown that looked like it dated to the late Old Republic, but was probably just an in-vogue dress on some backwater world. "So, where's the coordinator?" he asked, making the question sound innocuous.
"I don't know, sir."
"Any idea when opening arguments are supposed to begin?" The server reached up to tug at her earlobe. Just a nervous gesture, except Jason could feel the lie in the casual nature of her movement.
"I don't know that either. Perhaps they've broadcast the schedule to everyone's datapad."
"What did you just do?" Jason asked. The woman's nervousness increased by a factor of 10 or more.
"I answered your question."
"No." He leaned in close, intimidating. "When you touched your ear, tell me or I'll be forced to kill you." She looked right and left, as if seeking an avenue of escape or an observer.
"Please,"
she said.
"We're supposed to, if anyone asks questions."
"You sent a signal?"
"Yes."
Jason wheeled and walked quickly back toward the door by which they'd entered the big chamber. Through the Force, he reached out to Lumaya, a warning.
"Gentle beings."
The voice was so loud, broadcast from on high, that Jason was compelled to look. Toward the center of the great chamber, a hologram was forming, 6 meters high. It showed a male human in a white admiral's uniform. The cut and styling, more suited to the Palpatine-era Empire than to modern military forces.
If you'll turn your attention to the sky, you'll witness the forces of the Galactic Alliance emerging from the planet's atmosphere. This will be visible as a series of bright flashes as they begin to hit our mind grid. Closer to us, I'd like to introduce you to a distinguished visitor.
A spotlight from high above blared right into Jason's eyes.
If our specialists are worth what we're paying them, you may raise a glass to Colonel Jason Solo, Galactic Alliance Guard. Some of you Corellians may have lost relatives and friends to this man's many recent activities.
We haven't been introduced, Jason said. The giant hologram nodded.
General Tor Fenir, Supreme Commander of the Confederation Military, at your service.
I thought...
That today would be the day that office was elected?
Fenir shook his head, as if saddened by Jason's credulity.
A deception I thought would be useful in drawing your forces in. And your presence here is another benefit, an unexpected one. I know you're going to attempt to fight your way out, but I must ask... Please don't kill the delegates. They're only actors.
Behind Jason came the sound of running feet. The security agents. They, he was sure, were real. Yes, he'd fight his way out. But he had something to do first. He gestured upward toward Galadar 8 and put his whole heart into two thoughts. It's a trap. Mines. It's a trap, Luke shouted into his comlink. He's visualizing mines. I say again, mines!
Acknowledged, Stealth One, came the voice of the Voyager's comm officer. Be advised, with that transmission, your position is compromised.
No kidding. Stealth One out. Luke switched his comm board over to squadron frequency.
What now?
Mara asked. We go in, Luke said, and rescue Jason. Every officer on the Galactic Voyager bridge waited for the order to come. The order to take a new heading, to circumnavigate the mine grid ahead of them. That's not what they got.
Continue all ahead slow,
Niathal ordered.
All forward gun positions of all lead vessels open up in a sweep pattern directly forward. Second-tier capital ships and starfighters still in formation drop in behind the capital ships. The order is given for Anakin Solo and all outlying vessels to jump.
There was the briefest delay, and then the bridge crew turned to its new tasks. Galactic Voyager's commander, a Quarren named Squin, edged toward Niathal. His face tentacles were motionless with forced calm, but a question burned in his eyes. Niathal answered it.
If we hadn't gotten Solo's warning, Captain, what would have happened?
We would have advanced into the minefield.
Until?
Until our forward ships began hitting the mines.
And then?
Understanding dawned in the Quarren's expression.
We would have set a new course, a lateral course, into more mines that have been maneuvered into place while we were waiting here.
Niathal nodded.
Mines we couldn't detect because of the thicker atmosphere around and below us. Mines that would continue to close on us. This way we're going to be hammered. But with the fewest number of hammers they currently have to swing against us.
Understood.
Captain Squin edged away again. It's a trap, Leia said. Though Jason's force-based warning had not been intended for her, she could not have missed it. Not a panicky emotion from her own son. She leaned forward in the co-pilot seat of the Falcon, but the only thing visible from the Galadar system was its yellow star, straight ahead, distant and tiny. Han, did you hear me?
I did.
Han's face was, for once, a mask of indecision.
We have to go in and get him,
she said. The words hurt. Her anger at Jason's actions had not abated. She didn't trust him. But he was her son. She had to save him. The Tor Fenir hologram had appeared so close to Alima that she was initially partly within his right leg. She edged away, disappearing into the crowd. Getting to this meeting had been easier for her than for any other infiltrator, she thought. After all, memories of her presence faded from the minds of those she encountered mere minutes after she departed. That, and her Jedi skills, made a child's play for her to bypass guards, eavesdrop on conversations, and never stain the memories of those whose resources they used. Now she hoped she would not be noticed as she made her way from the main hall. She didn't think she would be. Jason Solo was doing too good a job of attracting everyone's attention. He stood alone, a semicircle of security guards from several different forces blocking his path. And as she watched, they opened fire. He leapt above the torrent of blaster shots, igniting his lightsaber as he rose, and came down behind his enemies. He spun, and two of them were suddenly headless. The rest fell back from him, firing as they turned. All Alima had to do was flee from this disaster, join the throngs of actors now moving in panicky retreat toward the shuttle access chambers. Then she felt her quarry. Leia was nearby, sending reassurance through the Force. To Jason. It had to be to Jason. That message certainly wasn't meant for her. But now she couldn't leave. She had to wait to see if Han was with Leia. Veering from her escape path, she made her way to a wall and merged with the shadows there. In the shadow where she was hiding, Alima saw two figures force their way in through the streams of actors trying to escape. They were Luke Skywalker and Mara Jade Skywalker, dressed in black jumpsuits with X-Wing pilot's accoutrements. And Alima nearly passed out from happiness. Luke was here and would see Mara die. Leia was still coming. The universe was about to experience some much-needed balance. She stopped bouncing up and down long enough to find her comlink. She spoke into it. Activate and execute approach 2. On the Duracrud, now floating with all the other arrival craft steered to the holding area by resort security personnel, the nav computer would be loading and implementing a set of simple maneuvers. The Duracrud would move to a position directly above the resort's dome, a few kilometers away, and then begin accelerating.
What are you doing, Dancer?
The voice was cold, amused, familiar, and it froze Alima's guts. She tore her attention away from the fight, where Jason was coping with an ever-growing number of security agents, and looked to the right. The dark-skinned woman who had addressed her did not look familiar, except for her build and her green eyes.
Lumaya, she said. I asked you a question.
Alima gave her a one-shouldered shrug.
We are here to kill Mara Jade Skywalker, who is here, and Han Solo, who is coming. And you? I was about to dive in and help Jason.
Do not do that.
Alima shook her head vehemently.
If you rescue him, Luke and Mara will leave, and Leia and Han will not come. They must be here.
Lumaya considered.
Then let's jump in together. Our being here will keep the Skywalkers and Solos from leaving. Don't you think? We do.
Lumaya reached down and tore a long gap in her gown, freeing her legs to maneuver. She unwrapped the decorative scarf she wore as a belt, revealing the light whip beneath it, and rewrapped the scarf around her lower face and scalp, giving her the aspect of Lumaya so familiar to Alima and others. Then she drew her light whip.
Ready?
Alima brought her lightsaber up.
We are.
She was happier than she had been in a long, long time. Luke and Mara made their approach a merciful one. They landed in the midst of the thickest group of security officers. Luke's lightsaber flashed in a circle, severing 5 or 6 blaster barrels, and Mara gestured with the Force to sweep aside 6 agents. Luke deflected a blaster shot from an opportunistic Corsec woman. Let's go, Jason. Your ride's waiting. Jason struck, cutting a Bothan shooter in 2.
I don't need your help.
Then he looked past Luke, and his expression hardened still more.
Oh no.
Luke glanced back that way. Han and Leia were entering the main hall at a dead run.
And your other ride is here.
Then he heard Mara's warning hiss, more through the Force than with his ears. And when he turned back again, Lumaya stood before him. As Han and Leia approached, the nature of the battle before them changed in an instant. Abruptly, Luke was drawing and igniting his second lightsaber, the half-length Shoto, and using his primary lightsaber to deflect a weapon that looked oddly like Lumaya's light whip. Han squinted. The wielder was Lumaya, though her skin was dark. He raised his blaster and fired, but Lumaya must have been aware of him. She simply twisted aside and the bolt caromed off the floor, then passed through the chest of the 6-meter hologram of an admiral that dominated the center of the room. Mara, nearly surrounded by security agents, was batting their blaster fire back at them with her own lightsaber. Leia angled away from her toward Luke and then let out a surprised cry as a low table slid into her path, too suddenly for her to vault or sidestep. She tripped but came up on her feet and lit her lightsaber. She stopped abruptly and stared to the left. Han followed her gaze to see Alima Rar emerging from the wall-side shadows, an odd smile on her lips, her lit lightsaber in her hand. "Mine," Leia said, and leapt forward. Han ignored her. He fired at the Twi'lek, but Alima casually caught the bolt with her lightsaber, then began spinning her blade in a defensive pattern as Leia reached her. "I guess this settles the question of whether you're dead or not," Luke said. He caught another crack of the light whip on his long blade, darted in close, slashed at Lumaya with the Shoto. But with an exertion through the Force, she lifted a severed human head into the path of the blow, and Luke's attack sent the head spinning through the air. It landed on a table stacked with food.
"Of course," Lumaya said. "I thought you knew. I am dead. I have been for decades."
"Then lie down and let us throw dirt on top of you." With a similar telekinetic exertion, Luke whipped the tablecloth from beneath all the platters and hurled it at Lumaya. It swept upon her from behind, but she cracked her whip backward, cutting the tablecloth in two, then continued the maneuver into a forward stroke. Luke deflected separate light whip tendrils with his two blades.
"You really do hate me, don't you?" Lumaya asked. "You've given me plenty of reasons to, but no. I don't reciprocate your hate."
Luke leapt over another sweep of tendrils, coming down atop a chair and leaping free of it as Lumaya's follow-up attack disintegrated it. He landed lightly, poised.
"I don't hate."
She lowered her whip.
"I'm sorry you think that of me. I haven't hated for a very long time. Yes, I've tried to kill you, but that was professional, not personal."
Luke held up his own weapon long enough to deflect a stray blaster bolt, a security agent attack that merely strayed too near him, then lowered the lightsaber, matching Lumaya's action. "You don't hate? Somehow I don't believe that."
"We belong to rival schools, Luke. That's all. Shall I prove it?"
"Sure." Lumaya deactivated her light whip and wrapped it around her waist. She gestured palms up.
"Kill me. Now, if you want."
He took a step forward. "I don't want, but you're a never-ending threat to me and my family."
"Then take your shot. But first, for old time's sake, take my hand."
She extended her right hand, palm still upward, a gesture of peace. Luke gave her an exasperated look. "I can't believe you'd stoop to such a childish tactic."
"No tactic, Luke. Listen to my voice. Listen to my feelings. I'm not offering you poisoned fingers or force lightning. Just a touch."
Her voice became more sad.
"If I'd wanted to hurt you tonight, I would have killed your nephew instead of letting him flee."
"Flee?" Careful to keep Lumaya in his peripheral vision, Luke scanned the chamber. Most of the actors had disappeared. Leia was backing Alima up across the main hall, with Han following, taking potshots to provide support for his wife. The giant hologram was gone, and so was Jason. He left us.
"And I could have attacked you just now."
Luke returned his attention to Lumaya. He felt no danger through the Force. None at all. From her, there was only peaceful intent. He extinguished his lightsabers and hung them from his belt, then reached out with his left hand, his flesh hand. His fingers grazed hers,
and then her hand closed on his. And nothing happened.
Sweetheart!
Busy!
Leia swung an almost ceaseless flurry of blows at Alima, but the Twi'lek Jedi continued backing away, fighting a defensive action, never trying to attack. It was unlike her.
Jason's run off.
Han's words created a tight knot in Leia's chest.
She had risked her life, and Han his, to save their son. And Jason had just left them behind.
But she couldn't dwell on that. Alima was still a dangerous foe. Leia had to win here.
Sweetheart?
Now what?
Incoming!
Leia backflipped away from her enemy, and in mid-rotation saw that the view of Galadar 8 was partially blocked. The same ship she'd seen Alima disappear in only days before was headed straight for them. As she landed, she saw that Alima had switched off her lightsaber and was donning a close-fitting, flexible helmet with a transparent faceplate. An emergency decompression helmet. Alima smiled at her.
Luke felt the danger coming, but it was not coming from Lumaya. He turned away and looked up, just in time to see the YV-666 contact the top of the dome. The dome, ancient transparasteel, did not shatter. It caved in, crumpling like a thin-walled metal can. The great mass of the ship hurtled to crash into the floor of the main hall, and a ripple like a tidal wave coursed through the floor. Luke leapt toward the exit. Mara was ahead of him. He saw the ripple effect from the impact bounce bodies up off the flooring, and the cargo ship, its speed hardly checked, continued plowing into the floor, punching a ragged hole through the axis of the space station. Beyond it, he thought he saw the relit tendrils of Lumaya's whip lashing. Against what? An enemy? A wall, to provide her with an escape path. Suddenly, the whip was obscured by an expanding cloud of debris, kicked up by the YV-666's impact. The station's atmosphere, with two huge holes to choose from, began fleeing into space, tugging at Luke as it went. Of those fleeing toward the exit, Leia was in the rear, Han just ahead of her. The ripple shock from the floor impact behind them took Han off his feet. Nimble and determined, he was up again before Leia even reached him. Up, but moving slowly, increasingly to Leia's eyes, Han's feet seemed not to want to find purchase as he ran. Nor did hers. It wasn't from the atmosphere escaping. The station's artificial gravity had to have experienced a complete failure. As her ears popped and pain grew in her head and eyes, Leia knew that there was no way they could reach the exit. No way they both could reach it. She reached out through the Force and shoved Han's back, propelling him forward through the door Luke and Mara had just reached. Leia took three more steps, but now, though her legs kept thrashing, she could make no headway at all. Her feet lifted clear of the floor. She had no forward momentum, no way to reach safety. She closed her eyes, determined to be peaceful in her last moments. Something wrapped around her ankle. She looked down. Attached to her leg was a line with a tiny hook and grapnel. Luke's piece of stupid, preposterous farm boy equipment, which he'd carried off and on since before she'd met him. He was at the far end of the line, braced against the door, hauling with all his strength. And as Leia watched, Han joined him. In moments, they had dragged her through the door and into the shuttle access bay, where they had arrived minutes before. Han sealed the door. Dimly, in the reduced atmospheric pressure, she could hear a warning siren wailing. Leia lay on the floor, panting.
"Thanks,"
she said. "What's family for?" Luke asked. "Hey, can Mara and I get a lift around to the other side of the station? Our stealth X's are over there."
Galata system.
In the shuttle he'd seized, Jason hurtled toward the Anakin Solo, broadcasting his identity as he went, demanding updates on the battle. He could see how it was progressing. The Confederation ships had been ready for the Alliance task force, but they hadn't been ready for the Alliance vessels to muscle their way through the mine grid, throwing off time estimates and ruining carefully planned flanking maneuvers. What had resulted was a slugging match, and to his eyes, things were even.
He needed more than his eyes. Even when he got data from the Anakin Solo, it was only as good as the ship's instruments could provide, as good as harried, overburdened officers could analyze. He saw a Bothan assault cruiser lose power to its portside batteries. Instantaneous response on the part of the Alliance starfighter squadrons could have exploited the situation, which could have resulted in the cruiser's destruction. It didn't happen. He saw starfighter squadrons circling, looking for an enemy, wasting precious minutes until the Galactic Voyager could direct them to a worthwhile target. He saw an Alliance frigate yield the field because its commander obviously felt the vessel was crippled, unaware that its Corellian corvette counterpart was even more badly damaged. He cursed and pounded on the arms of his pilot's seat. Finally, he found an opportunity to board the Anakin Solo. Not long after, Lumaya reached him on his private comlink channel, reporting that she too had seized a vehicle. Someone's private transport, little more than an airspeeder fitted with improved engines and an atmospheric containment hull, and needed landing authorization for the Anakin Solo. Grudgingly, for he knew she would talk to him and he didn't wish to talk to anyone, he provided her the code she needed. In the final analysis, the Battle of Galadar 8 was a draw, with both sides retiring the field after suffering moderate losses. The Confederation trumpeted it as a clear victory for Tor Finnir and his cool-headed new Supreme Commander. The Alliance noted the fact that even with superior odds and the advantage of a treacherous ambush, the Confederation had accomplished nothing.
Aboard the Anakin Solo.
Jason sat in his private office. The glow rods were dimmed, and the only illumination came from the corkscrewing streaks of hyperspace light outside his viewport. Whisper quiet, the hidden panel in the corner of his office retracted and opened. Lumaya entered, her face devoid of makeup, but wrapped against prying eyes.
"I can feel your anger all the way to my quarters," she said.
"Are you admonishing or approving?"
"I approve of the anger, of course. It strengthens you, and you need strength. But if I can feel it..."
"There are no other Jedi aboard Anakin Solo."
"Prove it. And while you're at it, prove that there are no nascent Jedi, no Force sensitives of any sort."
Jason sighed. He did not relinquish his anger, but he did concentrate on diminishing his own presence in the Force.
"Good."
Lumaya approached and seated herself opposite him.
"Jason, this was not a disaster."
"I was made to look like an idiot. I planned the mission. I bought into the trap."
"As did everyone, including Admiral Nyathol, the mission commander. When the full report of the battle reaches the Hollow News, it will be cast as a dramatic Galactic Alliance success. The forces of good beating back a treacherous ambush, all with negligible losses. And you will probably find your popularity has grown. As for blame behind closed doors of government, your information was independently verified, wasn't it?"
"Yes. All right then, I was made to feel like an idiot."
"Ah, there I cannot reassure you."
He shot her a glare, but said nothing.
"Would you like to avoid this in the future? To be matchless, undefeatable in strategic engagements?"
"No one is undefeatable."
"Perhaps not. But the commander knows exactly where all the battlefield's forces are, who does not need to depend solely on limited sensors and fallible analysts, will be defeated much less often."
"You're talking about battle meditation. You've mentioned it before."
"No. Battle meditation is something many very accomplished Force users, Jedi and Sith, can do. Consider battle meditation to be the learner. The technique I'm talking about is the master. It is the capacity to sense, to coordinate, just by the power of the mind and the will. This is the ability that comes with the assumption of the title of Master of the Sith."
He continued to stare at her. "You aren't the master, so you can't teach it to me."
"I'm not, but I can. A blind woman who was once sighted can still experience colors in her memory.
I learned everything there was to learn about this power. I can just never wield it.
Lumaya stared down at her limbs. Her expression did not suggest that she felt betrayed by them, by their robotic nature, only that they were a bit disappointing. Jason considered it. Am I ready?
In all other ways, yes. But you have to make the sacrifice of love, and then you must take your Sith name to reforge yourself.
Who must I sacrifice? The question put a chill through him. If she were to say the one you love most, he would be unable to do it. He would never sacrifice Alana. He would never sacrifice Tenel Ka.
One you love. One who will leave a void in your heart.
Anyone?
Anyone.
Jason stared off into the distance. Then it will be my father, or mother, or both.
Or perhaps not.
Jason stared at her, curious. Do you have a sudden affection for them I should know about? Lumaya laughed.
No. I have forgiven Leia for what she has done to me, and Han was never much of a nuisance. But it may be that you can't sacrifice your parents.
Why?
You must sacrifice one you love. Are you certain you still love them? Search your feelings.
Jason thought, and then reluctantly abandoned thinking to open himself to his emotions. He let images of Han and Leia float in his mind's eye. He saw them as they had been when he was a toddler, as a teenager, as a man. He saw them in the ever-changing light of his own experiences, as he came to realize they could not be ordinary parents, as he discovered that they were willing to abandon him and his siblings to surrogate parents for weeks or months at a time, as he learned that they had to. He felt again the wash of pain that all those separations had caused, that all those reunions had never healed. All he could feel was pain and anger. Pain they had caused. Anger he bore against them. But had the anger replaced the love? Or did anger simply mask it? As hard as he sought an answer, he could not find one. Lumaya whispered in his ear.
You don't know because you have trained yourself to feel too little, to analyze too much. That is not the Sith way. You must do both.
Jason shook his head. Emotion weakens you.
Yet anger and emotion gives you strength. Emotion doesn't weaken you, Jason. It scares you. You specifically.
He stared at her, suddenly furious. Nothing scares me! He could not see her face beneath her scarf, but he knew that she was smiling.
Liar,
she said. Before he could formulate an answer, she rose and returned to the secret passage.
I was wrong, she said. You're not quite ready. You don't know yourself as well as you must. Find yourself, Jason. Then make your sacrifice and take your Sith name. I'll be waiting.
She departed, and the door slid closed behind her. Jason stared after her, feeling ill. Ill that he had a weakness, that Lumaya had detected it, that he was confused. And now he could not even begin the process of choosing his sacrifice until he knew where his heart lay, until he knew whether he loved his parents. In one way, though, both answers to that question were similar. If he loved them, he should sacrifice one and kill the other to prevent retaliation. If he did not love them, he should consider eliminating them and the potential trouble they represented. Either way, both he and the galaxy would be better off without them. Goodbye, Mom, he said. Goodbye, Dad.
This is Mark Thompson. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Star Wars: Legacy of the Force, Exile. This program was produced, directed, and abridged by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer, Jacob Bronstein. Star Wars: Legacy of the Force, Exile is a production of Lucasfilm Limited. Copyright 2007. All rights reserved. Used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production Copyright 2007, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.
Gilata system, approaching Gilata 8 orbit.
The greatest reward came from the greatest risks, Jason had said, and Lumaya had agreed with him.
So long as you accurately assess the reward and the risks,
she'd added. And then she had volunteered to accompany him on his expedition to infiltrate the Confederation election ceremony. Setting it up had been easy enough. It had been Galactic Alliance intelligence that had discovered there would be representatives of the Hapes Consortium Heritage Council, the conspiracy that had collaborated with Corellia to kill Tenel Ka, at the meeting. And Admiral Nyathol had been the first to propose the authenticated independence groups, even from worlds most devoted to the Galactic Alliance, might find admission. It hadn't been too much work for Jason to persuade Nyathol that he be the Galactic Alliance agent assigned to attend the meeting. His status as the Jedi with the closest ties to the military ensured him that right. Manipulating things so that Lumaya could accompany him had been trickier. But she admitted to maintaining a number of fully detailed false identities that would withstand scrutiny from either side's intelligence division. And one of them, that of smuggler Sylphinia L, had a registered world of birth that would fit the profile GA intelligence needed. So Jason had arranged for documents for himself and Sylphinia from the Essien government, and now, his features heavily disguised under dark spray-on skin color and a beard, he carried an identicard showing him to be a member of Essien's most violent revolutionary party. Working through Captain Levint and her mysterious contacts, he had been able to wrangle an admission to the ceremony, but not a vote. That was fine. He wasn't there to vote. He was there to note faces, identify traitors, and distract everyone present, perhaps by killing them all, when the battle began. And Lumaya was beside him, acting as a backup in case of trouble. Her scarred features concealed under her expertly applied makeup, she now had dark skin and hair like his. From this shallow depth within the atmosphere of Gilata 8, the crews of the Alliance Force had a decent view of the distant space station and the stars beyond. The atmosphere made the stars twinkle just a little and made their view slightly hazy. That was all.
Tight beam transmission from Stealth 1, Nyathol's aide told her on the bridge of the Galactic Voyager. A Hutt-like cruiser arriving, but that's the only capital ship in the last half hour. The rate of major arrivals has dropped nearly to zero. Nyathol, sitting in her multiply articulated swivel command chair, grimaced. The odds were now just the wrong side of even, which would be problematic in a straight-up fight. Fortunately, the Alliance had the advantage of surprise.
Very well, she said,
her words merely acknowledging that she'd heard her aide's report.
Any major players still missing?
No, ma'am.
Nyathol raised her voice so that it could be heard across the entire bridge.
Issue the order to the fleet. All ahead, slow. The outlying vessels are not to jump until they receive a direct command.